Morning, Carmen. Okay, shkoach to Ben for organizing, scheduling. So we have three sessions, so I thought I would focus the first session just on not necessarily the methodology of how, but perhaps an even more compelling question of why, and what does this all mean? You come to yeshiva, you're thrust into the deep end of lumdas, and at some point you're overwhelmed by the techniques and the apparatus that you have to employ, but in the back of your mind, you're haunted sometimes, what does this all mean? What are we chasing? Especially since the type of study is so different than not just the general studies you've been exposed to, but even in Gemara study in high school or other forms of Limud HaKodesh in high school where the setting doesn't allow or doesn't invite the type of what seems like chaotic, serendipitous lumdas without any fixed endpoint. What are we searching for? Why is it so important? And especially when you feel the collective weight of yeshivas across the world is not just a Gush Etzion phenomenon. All of a sudden, every yeshiva, people are spending so much time investing in lumdas. Why? What does it all mean? What's the purpose of lumdas? I've spoken about this before to some of you, but I thought it may make sense to take a step back and present it in an organized fashion. And then once we know a little bit about the why, to try to catalog the techniques and the tools. Okay. Religion is, of course, pitched on the encounter between a human being and a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Certainly the modern forms of religion all demand that. It could be that ancient forms of religion accepted distance and differentiation, but we certainly want to talk to Hashem, we want to feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence, we want to emote full range of human emotions, primarily Ahavas Hashem, Miras Hashem, the knowledge of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But that encounter is plagued by the discrepancy between limited, frail, mortal, intellectually vulnerable human beings, or limited in their capacity, and the infinite sweep of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's wisdom, which is beyond any human knowledge and any human comprehension. And more or less, paganism is an attempt to humanize God and process God into composite human form. In the gross fashion, it's very human, it's very physical, idols, molten images, environmental elements, animals, planets. In more progressive forms of what we call hybrids between paganism and monotheism, and certainly Christianity, at least at its inception, is a hybrid because fundamentally God is transcendent and his child is human, so it's literally a glaring hybrid. So it's a little more elegant, a little more sophisticated, a little less crass, but it's still an attempt to humanize God to render him accessible to the limited human imagination.
I'm just curious if you view different parts of Kabbalah also as having that aim of combining different
things. No, because Kabbalah always establishes, without diving too deeply into Kabbalah, Kabbalah maintains a clear boundary between a Kodesh Baruch Hu, who is the infinite unknown, what's called in the Kabbalah the Ein Sof, and all the physical elements are merely emanations of a Kodesh Baruch Hu's presence, the translation of Hashem, but it tries to create that differentiation. Whereas in Christianity, Lahavdil, there's a three-person God or a three-element God, two of which are physical. Okay, but we're not here to discuss comparative religion. Anyway, so in Judaism, how do we encounter HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So obviously, the encounter of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is multi-layered, by imitating his moral image, by speaking to him, by participating in the historical evolution that he expects of us. It's through many different forms of worship, submission, intellectual, but the clearest representation or approximation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in human terms is his will. So take, for example, let's say you could never meet me and you wanted to know a little bit about me, but you couldn't meet me face to face. So you'd have two strategies. One strategy is you were invited into my home. You could study my life. You can study my creation. You could study my bedroom. You could study the type of house I've built, type of library I've assembled, the type of food I prepare for Shabbos. You could probably infer much about me from studying my creations. You can interview my children, which are not my direct creations, but I have a hand in steering them and developing them. So you can try to infer my identity from the things I've created. Why does he like the color red? Why does he have these paintings? Why does he have this architectural structure? You can read my Chiddushei Torah. But if, let's say, you submitted a list of 100 questions to me, what my opinion about such and such is, what my opinion about such and such were, presumably that list of questions would be more revealing about my essence than just trying to infer my identity from the things I've created, because the form is much more speculative, the second is more direct. If those 100 questions weren't 100 questions but 1,000 questions, they'd be more lucid. If it were 100,000 questions, they'd be more precise. It'd be 1,000,000 questions. So Torah is a compilation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will, but every aspect of human experience. So in the classic sense, if you take a nature walk or you study a block Gemara, as much as in common parlance, a nature walk would seem to be more spiritual and more epiphanous and more revelatory, but by nature, you're trying to access HaKadosh Baruch Hu through his creatures and through his basically the house he's built. Whereas in Torah, you're trying to access HaKadosh Baruch Hu through his will, which is more direct. Now, for each person, that balance and that proportion between how much nature and how much tefillah and how much chesed and how much is can be different. But that's why Torah is always seen as Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, is always seen as the most direct conduit to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And in Chazal's terminology, it receives various metaphors to convey this association. So at some points it's called the daughter of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a very famous medrash in Truma, that Hashem couldn't live with us, but he sent his daughter to live with us, V'yicholi Truma, that's why we purchased the Torah, V'kitz Mechiyim Mechazikim Ba. It's called alternatively Shem Hashem, so my name isn't Moshe. Let's say my name changed overnight to Ari. It would be a little awkward for you tomorrow to answer Ari, but presumably I'd recover, and within a few minutes I'd be the same person, the same values, the same experiences, the same personality. I just have to get used to being called Ari. But when people want to call my name, they don't say the man who's sitting in the corner dressed in a checkered shirt with blue pants. It's an easier way to access me. So my name isn't my essence. It's just an access point. You call me Moshe or Rabbi Taragan just to get my attention and or to refer to me in abstract. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence isn't Torah, but it's the way we access him. It's the way we can access HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Hashem can't be contained by the Torah, but it's only the way that human beings access him in the same way that I call you by your name. So the Torah writes in Parshas Azino, Ki Shem Hashem Ekra HaVugadol Elokeinu, Chazal interpret the phrase Shem Hashem, Brachas Dav Chavalov, as a reference to Torah. This is the Makar for Brachas HaTorah, where the Pasuk in the end of Yisro says, B'chol HaMakom Asher Azkir HaShemi, so Mishnah Aval says, see, these are the two instances in Tanakh where Chazal interpreted Shem Hashem as a metaphor for Torah. It's not Hashem's essence, it's a metaphor for Torah. Now that all sounds very interesting and intriguing in the abstract level. And then you open up Bava Kama Daf Chaf Peis and you're reading about a detail about fire and say, well, this doesn't feel divine. This feels very picayune, very detailed, very random. It's one thing if Hashem's will I expect to be majestic, panoramic, challenging, global, sophisticated, abstract. And Shas seems to be a random array of details. So all that I've spoken about seems very attractive and abstract. But what about Shas in particular, which is what we're here to talk about? Not to talk about the Chamish Shechem Shetara, but we're considering the value and the importance of studying Shas. So, of course, that is primarily a failure of us, not a failure of the system. Take, for example, the way you process the world. You process the world holistically, right? You see the world, you don't look at, you're obviously able to hone in on a tree or on a blade of grass, but there's an experience. You walk through this world, you're able to process. You're processing the world you're walking through, the people you're meeting, the winds that are blowing. It's a multi-sensory experience. It's not just little details, but let's say you're taking a walk in a forest and you're looking at a river and at a tree and at the leaves and at the flowers and at the animals. And it's a multi-sensory experience. It's all integrated. Now, at a certain point in your life, you felt a tree. You honed in on a tree. You felt its texture. You placed it into context. Each of those elements in a multi-variabled experience, you sensed individually. You honed in on it at some early stage when you were 2 years old or 3 years old. And since it was so innate and so deeply woven into your identity, you were able then to feel all these stimuli and all these objects in your world and all these emotions and experiences in a very holistic fashion, that it feels seamless to you. It's not like you have to study the tree, then study the flower, and then study the gust of wind, and study the sky, and study this moon, and study. It all melds together into one, let's say, aesthetic experience. Same way a symphony melds together, because you have assimilated all these elements and objects at a very, very early age. Well, that's the way great people study Torah. You're all coming. I came to Torah at a very late stage, 17. My wiring was already established. Now let me open a book and try to rebuild a system that should have been endowed to me in a more holistic fashion at an early age. So you talk about Gedolim. Gedolim become Gedolim, not because they start studying Gemara at 17 and they study just with more intensity and more passion and more effort. In part, it's because when the Rav was 3 years old, at his table, he wasn't discussing sports or comics or cartoons or playing round pegs and square holes. He was discussing with his father at a very, very holistic level the world and the system of Torah. He's discussing what a Kenyan is and what he wasn't discussing, a Tosos and Bava Kamma, or discussing a Rashba and Bava Metzia. Here he's describing Das, Gemira's Das, Kavana, Ishus, Chalos, Hafka, Bittul, Ones, just concepts that later became associated with specific addresses. So for us, it appears details, but that's only because we're studying it at such a late level in our, not just our lives, but in our developmental arcs. After we've already established the baseline of our character, now we're trying to download information as opposed to integrating it within our sense, our sensory experience. So the question is obviously for us, because this is not Talmudic methodology assessment for Rabbi Soloveitchik and for Gedolim, but just to be able, even before you adapt it to your experience, to realize the tragedy and the fallen state with which we address Torah. Very often, failures are not, we assign blame to the wrong addresses for failures. When the real problem with the Iguna today the real problem is the criminal who holds back the get. But the global structural problem is we just don't have a Beis Din. If we had a Beis Din, we could solve Iguna overnight. Every recalcitrant husband would be coerced into delivering a get for his wife. So it's really a failure of Jewish history, which expresses it on many fronts. The fact that we can't change kidneys, or we can't change the Shani Shagolis, we just don't have the machinery to make changes because we're still landlocked in an experience of exile, which is absent of any Beis Din to enact new takanas and new decrees. So the same thing here. The struggle with Gemara is because we're studying it as details, and as details, so I have to tell you, okay, now appreciate them not as details, but as a term that I've used often, you may have heard it from me, it's a very fancy term, but I think it's a useful term as a hieroglyph. The code is maybe more of a modern usage, but think about Egyptian hieroglyphs. We see an image, but that image represents systems or systems of thought or human interactions. We can have a code, you can have any icon or hieroglyph or avatar, anything that represents something else. Now in this case, the detail is a hieroglyph to a category. That's really at the core of Lamdas, trying to turn every detail into a category. To say every detail, what is this detail about Kedushin? Tell me about the definition, the anatomy, the functioning of the Maisa Kedushin. What is this detail, the reason it fails here, because as you've heard me say so often, kryptonite is just a very, very popular detail. A failure of a rule proves the rule, because you can hone in on the X factor, what makes it fail. To understand Superman, you want to understand the chemical makeup of kryptonite, then you understand his biofunctioning. Well, what aspect of his strength is kryptonite compromised? So every detail you find at every level, whether it's a Gemara or a Rishon or an Achron, what does this show me about the category? Now, the more categories you build and the more similar categories you assemble, then you could start to assemble larger scale models that are more representative of this resplendency and majesty of Hashem's will. So, for example, if you wanted to understand Hashem's will about marriage, so it's pretty condensed. You'd study Nashim. Nashim has five sections: the launching of a marriage, Kiddushin, the dismantling of a marriage, Gerushin, surrogate marriage, Yivamos, betraying marriage, Sota, and Nedarim, which is loosely related to marriage because it talks about certain rites of repealing Nedarim, which marriage installs. And each of these sections, launching, dismantling, surrogate, betrayal, let's leave Nedarim out for a moment. Okay, but these four sections, because Nedarim is pretty much a peripheral, these four sections contain X amount of categories. Those categories could be called by X cubed or X to the 10th amount of details. And if you assemble those categories, you could start building what is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's definition of marriage. It's a very, very large question, and it floats along many categories, and I'll describe the pyramid-like structure in a moment. Just a second, let this unfold. But at least you're constantly working up what I call a pyramid structure. Two details or several details provide a certain category. So let's say I align 7 or 10 details about the way a Maisa Kedushin functions. So now I've built the category, how do I define a Maisa Kedushin? And then I take that category, the next level up, Maisa Kedushin, and I've defined Chalos Kedushin, I've defined Chiyuve Kedushin, and I've defined other parallel categories, and I take those 10 categories and build a meta category. And then I know how Hashem wants Kedushin to unfold. And then I take 10 meta categories, let's say how Kedushin should unfold, how Kedushin should be broken, how Kedushin should be substituted for, and then at some point, as I work my way up the pyramid, I've got a large concept that contains an encompassing, completely incorporated statement, what is Hashem's will about marriage? It's probably too high up the pyramid for most people to ever reach. It's probably even too high up the pyramid for even human beings to articulate, even if you've reached it. But in theory, we are partaking of little nuggets of those larger categories. So,
is there a piece of chalk here? I'm going to grab a piece of chalk because the vision's here. Hey, Mom.
Piece of paper, as you can see. Okay. So if you imagine this extremely large pyramid, okay, and at the bottom of the pyramid, you're going to assemble 10 cells, which represent 10 details of Kedushin, and this will provide, I'm just approximating it, this will provide a meta concept called how do you define a Maisa Kedushin. I'll be fed by 10 principles located roughly between Daf Dalet Amud Aleph and Daf Zayin Amud Aleph and Kedushin. And then you'll locate another 6 or 7 details, and that will help you define how the Chalos HaKedushin unfolds. How does the status of Kedushin, not the Maisa Kedushin, but the Chalos Kedushin, can it be divided in half? Can it be applied with a delay? Can it be deployed on condition? And then you'll line up another meta concept, a category on, I don't know, the das of Kedushin. What type of das do you need in Kedushin? And you'll line up 20 details. So now you'll have these categories. I've defined das Kedushin the following way, defined Maisa Kedushin the following way, I've defined Chalos Kedushin the following way. Let's say, I'll make this more simple for you, now I'm able to articulate what Hashem's Ratzon is about Kedushin, how it's launched. And then I would work in parallel to define how Kedushin is dismantled, and define the Maisa Gerushin, and define the Dasa Gerushin, and define the Chalosa Gerushin, and then have a larger statement, a category, about how Hashem's definition of Gerushin unfolds. And then I do the same in Yavamos, let's say, and now I'd have the same in Sota, what is a betrayal of Kedushin entail, a betrayal of Nisuin, like differentiate right now between Kedushin and Nisuin. Now I take these 4 meta categories, and through synthesizing them, I could come up with a large level statement, how does Hashem see Kedushin? And then I can take that statement and hold it alongside how does Hashem see, let's say, Kenyan, and I can talk about how does Hashem see transactions, which change the status, because presumably changing the status of a person would have parallelisms to changing the status of an object or changing the status of other monetary issues. And as I work my way up this pyramid, and each level I go higher, you're getting to what I call megalambdas, or meta-analysis, which I know that when I give shir, I have a real taifa to get engaged in. I have to hold myself back, especially when I'm teaching Bava Metzias and Bava Basas, because everything is linking to something else, and I'm constantly trying to climb up that pyramid. Those of you who go to Yeshiva University, everybody, Rosenzweig does this a lot. He's very engaged in meta-lambdas, where it's not just trying to assign a detail that you've encountered in the sugya to a category, but taking categories and building larger categories, then taking those larger categories and associating them with parallel larger categories and building even larger categories, and seeing the system, in theory, as you work your way up this pyramid, if Hashem is truly indivisible, you can't divide him. He's not like you and I. You can divide the body and soul, the molecules, and the conscious, preconscious. Hashem is echad, is indivisible. And in Shemar Echad, similarly, Torah should be indivisible. So in theory, as you work your way up the pyramid, when you get to the apogee, you'd be able to articulate one coherent statement that incorporates all of Hashem's will. And that would be called the theory of everything in our jargon. So in theory, if you really knew Shas well, which I don't think any person would ever be able to, but in theory, if you really knew it well, you can keep working your way up the pyramid and get more general, not Hashem's will about marriage, or Hashem's will about transactions, or Hashem's will about experience, or Hashem's will about the seeds, or just be HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will, period. And that logical statement would incorporate his will about everything. It's beyond human comprehension, but that's how the structure is built. Now, some systems, let's just one more statement, and I'll get to your questions in a moment. Some systems allow, or some systems present this in a condensed and organized fashion. So I mentioned marriage. Marriage, more or less, you open Meseches Nashim or Seder Nashim with all the corollary references, and you pretty much can build an image of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. Monetary interactions, more or less, contracts, Bava Metzia, neighborly laws, Bava Basra. Some topics are just scattered, and then you have to cull the information and organize them on your own. So, for example, let's say you wanted to know Hashem's definition of architecture. How does Hashem define walls and space and zones and buildings? And so there is no Seder called architecture. You'd have to call information from Shabbos, in which the difference between public and private zones are described. You have to call information from Aulos, in which we're considering the role of structures in conferring Tumah. You have to gather information from Kelayim, structures separating wheats and grains. You'd have to, grapes and grains. You'd have to gather information from Erevin, fictitious zoning and fictitious walls, or virtual walls, as we would call it in our jargon. You'd have to study sukkah, the walls of a sukkah, and how they differ in contrast, which we are studying sukkah. So some of them are not as easily accessible and not as condensed and organized as the laws of marriage or the concepts of marriage. And that's why that's the double jeopardy of Shas. That's a double challenge, not just it's so striated and multi-layered, but it's so scattered. Because they knew it so intuitively, and we'll talk about this later, so they were able to seamlessly switch between one conversation and another, and as the conversation meandered from topic to topic, they felt less impelled before the Rambam, of course, wrote his Sefer, to write a topically organized Sefer. They just carried on conversations. They repeated the conversations that they had engaged in. So that's really a quick introduction to the introduction of what we're after, what we're searching for when we study Shas. Why isn't it so important? We'll talk about the differences, different types of study, and of course we'll get to the technique, but that's why Shas is so important to us. That's why the Rambam in Hilchos Talmud Torah, when he editorializes the Gemara and Kiddushin, the Gemara and Kiddushin talks about splitting your time for Talmud Torah in three, Shlish B'Mikra, Shlish B'Mishnah, Shlish B'Talmud. The Rambam reorients that. The Rambam says that's developmental. You should study as much Torah as you can until you know the entire Torah. But once you know the entire Torah, yikari beitim mizumanim b'mikra of a Mishnah. You chazer up your Mishnayos and your Gemara, because for him, Mishnah isn't just Mishnah, it's Gemara as well. V'yafane kol yamav le'gemara. Basically, you should spend your entire time in what we would call lamdas. Because the Rambam sees this as the highest form of learning, what we would call lamdas. Of course, different sectors read that Rambam differently. The yeshiva world has taken that Rambam to mean we evaluate Gemara as the highest form of learning and therefore we'll almost ignore everything else. The Rambam's truer intention, again, I'm perfectly comfortable with their adaptation, but it's not the Rambam's intention. They could have adapted it for the modern world. The Rambam's intention is you should first have a complete command of all of Torah, Mikra, Mishnah, and Gemara, and then once you reach that command of Kala Torah Kula, then you can engage in lamdas. The yeshivish response is, we just don't have the time. We live in a fallen world. And if we spend time gathering information, we'll never be able to thrust ourselves into the ideal form of learning. But everyone agrees that learning lamdas, at least from the Rambam's perspective, is the highest achievement towards which we aspire, because it's best able to provide that detailed will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as it relates to the totality of human experience. It's not one part of human experience, architecture, biology, water, irrigation, marriage, contracts, any part of external human experience. If you want to know Hashem's will, you don't just want to speculate based on a pasuk, a one-word pasuk, but you want to actually articulate will as a scientist. Scientist collects information, and he draws inferences, and he induces. I can induce from all these statements that Hashem's will is so-and-so and such-and-such. If I want to uncover that will, then I have to really engage in this detailed lattice of details of Shas. Okay, questions? Sam?
How do you reconcile the idea of lamdas being a prism of representation of God's will with the fact that Torah Shabbat is also a product of human interpretation?
Okay, so we'll get to that. This is just the introduction. And really the question, that your question begs more about machlokas, or why aren't we looking for the will of Hashem? Why do we waste so much time hunting down positions which may not be the will of Hashem? So it's a related question. It's more of a practical question, it's more of a metaphysical question. Yes?
The categories that you describe, like the host kitchen and, you know, get and all those things, they end up in, like, machloko. They don't end up with one.
Okay, so I mentioned that to say. I'll talk about that. Okay, how do we deal with machlokas? Yes?
A statement like Gemara asked the Hillel to say kol Torah kol ragal achas, responds by after racha kamochas. That would be, like, his top of the pyramid.
Or it would be a top point of a sub-pyramid. It wouldn't be the apogee of the pyramid. That's ridiculous. It was practically, it was an apogee that he felt within the pyramid could spawn much of the pyramid. But the top of the pyramid presumably is so abstract and so infinite that It's structurally similar, but it's not practically. In a very famous Rashi, how could you get to Ben Adam Lamakom throughout the Chikam Achaz? Rashi tells us, hey, Kodesh Baruch Hu is called your friend. But in theory, it's modularly serving the same point, that you can use it as a portal to access the entire Torah, for sure. Yes?
What kind of, when you say Lam, like after we learn Kol Torah, Kula, Mishnah, and Mikra, and you say we should be focusing on Lamdas after that, like the Rambam says we should be focusing on Lamdas after that, he wasn't a brisker, what kind of Lamdas do we mean?
Okay, so you're asking a question I'll talk about later. Do you really feel the Rambam thought in the same patterns that briskers do, or do you really think the Ramban thought in the same patterns? Is that your question? If you were convinced the Rambam did, then this question, you'd have your question answered, right?
Sure, I mean, partly, I'm curious, I don't think he really institutionalized brisk, you know, 800 years before Ochaim.
Okay, so we'll talk about this. I'll talk about how they thought. We'll get to it. I'm just setting up our target. Okay. Well, just because I wrote some notes and I've never given the shiur, so that's what I wanted to talk about now. In the modern parlance, this is called the brisker derech, to try to define categories. It's a din in, it's a geder of, it's a hagdara of, as you'll see, I'll tell you the terms of lechnasin used. In some circles, it's likened to or referred to in some cases flatteringly, in some cases very disparagingly, as a scientific method. The reason I would call it the scientific method, without getting lost in pompous names and declarations, is scientists ask the following question, and they completely avoid the following question. Scientists never ask why. Philosophers, metaphysicians, psychologists ask why. Scientists are always crunching data and asking what. So say, for example, you were invited to give a lecture in the University of the Sorbonne about biology, and you wanted to describe the combination of two molecules of hydrogen with one molecule of oxygen to form water. If you got up and said, why does hydrogen combine with oxygen? They'd laugh you off the stage. They'd say, you're in the wrong university. A scientist doesn't ask why hydrogen combines with oxygen. If you started to describe how it combines with oxygen, covalent bonding, ionic bonding, under heat, under pressure, they say, okay, this is a scientific conversation. Let's describe data. You provide your study, we'll provide our study, your facts, our facts. I feel it's covalent, I feel it's ionic, I feel under this pressure, under that circumstance. So it's scientific in that a brisker tries to avoid the question of why, at least initially. One second, I know there's a lot of questions. The question of why is less relevant. The question of how or what. And it's sometimes hard to make that division when you're first starting out learning on two fronts. First of all, you just have to know the way your mind operates. Are you asking a why question? Are you asking a what or how question? There was a Tana who felt very comfortable asking why in Talmudic conversations, but he was quickly shut down. Does anyone know which Tana I'm referring to? No, it was Rabbi Shimon, who was Darish Talmudic Ra. Rabbi Shimon was Darshin and Talmudic Ra. He would ask why and introduce those whys as information to the halacha conversation, and they paskined against him. Now, it's not that the why is insignificant. It's twofold. Number one, it's very, very speculative. Why did Hashem create the world? Why did Hashem create evil? You just don't have data to provide that answer. You just sit back, read a pasuk. That pasuk can be interpreted 3,000 different fashions, and you're also overmatched because you're trying to consider concepts that are far beyond human experience. Because when I want to try to define the category of Kedushin, I've got 1,000 bits of data. This tells us, that tells us. Forgetting for a moment the question of machlokas, but at least I've got the data, and I can attach data to logic. So at least it's much, much, much less speculative. And second of all, the hope is that ultimately the how and the what will yield the why. And this is something which the Rav articulates a lot in the Halachic Man, that in the ideal world, the why is a product of the what. Once you define the categories and what Hashem's will about Kedushin is, you're able to articulate a cogent statement about Hashem's Ratzon of Kedushin. Why did Hashem structure Kedushin this way rather than some other fashion? You're more educated, you're more informed, you have more to deal with, rather than just sitting back, so to speak, drinking a glass of tea and pontificating, why Hashem, I believe, why did Hashem do this or that, without really any information or baseline or basis for saying anything. It's basically, not why Hashem thought something, why I think Hashem, what I would want Hashem to think if I were Hashem. So then you're basically playing ventriloquy with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, rather than studying the categories that he outlined for us and then trying to spin or transform those categories into questions of why. So it's scientific in that it pursues data, draws conclusions, infers. Induction is when you try to take details and induce concepts. Deduction is when you take a concept and deduce a detail. So let's say I've taken this liquid in here, and I've tasted it, and I've poured it on the floor, and I've exposed it to heat. I've got all the data for those three experiments, taste, spillage, and heat exposure, and I place it on the table and say, based on the information I have available, I probably can ascertain that the liquid in here is water. Because it tastes like water, because it's more fluid than honey if it spills on the floor, because it melts, it condenses or freezes at a certain degree. Oh, now that I know this is water, I've induced the principle, now I can send this jug into space, and I can deduce that in zero gravity, it will act such and such. Or I can expose it to radiation, and I can deduce that when exposed to radiation, because I know the patterns and the properties of water. So that's what Gemara is. It's induction and deduction. I induce the principle, the category of 5 or 6. Oh, once I've defined condition, then I know that this is my definition, and in this shayla, I'll pass in such and such, and in that shayla about condition, because I've defined condition to be X rather than Y. So it's scientific in that it's induction and deduction. Again, for some people, the terminology scientific is very odious because it sounds like you're secularizing it, it's a college, and what is yeshiva is, a university. So for people for whom that terminology is pejorative, so I don't mean to use it in the pejorative sense. I just mean to use that it institutionalizes a process which is very similar to the scientific method. Now, most people today, I'll get back to Kobe's question just in a moment and to Alicia's question, most people today, more or less, I would say probably close to, 70% of the world studies Brisker-Lumdus style. Now, it's not always apparent that it's Brisker-Lumdus. Certainly in the presentation, it may not be as clearly defining categories, but that type of thought and learning has dominated the yeshiva world. Even when it is clear, I'm not so convinced how conscious people are that it is a Brisker method. Like I'm very conscious of the method. Those of you who came to my shiur, it's almost as if there are two shiurim taking place side by side. The Gemara we're learning, and which skills did we see today, and how can we apply these skills, and how can we exercise them elsewhere. And even when they're not two shiurim unfolding in parallel, I'm articulating even a shiur of this nature. What are the skills? What's the purpose? It's a consciousness rather than just engaging in a process which you've been trained towards, which maybe had been rendered intuitive by repetition. And I think the third difference, that why you won't hear things of this nature, let's say if you walk into Mir, even though most of the shiurim there are rendered in the Brisker Derech, is I don't know how much they're involved in meta-lumdus. I think they're much more, in most cases, much more satisfied with micro-lumdus. Namely, this detail proves that Kiddushin is defined as such and such. Maybe I'll associate 3 or 4 other details, but that sense of trying to describe larger models of the definition of Kiddushin, I think is something which is uniquely, let's say, institutionalized Brisk, and certainly something which Rav Aaron and Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Soloveitchik, more intuitively, I don't think Rav Soloveitchik articulated as such, but the sheer scope of some of the things he talked about implied that type of meta association and meta structure. But today, you walk into any yeshiva, if you break it down, if you strip it away, you strip away the coating, down to the copper wiring, that answer that the Rosh Yeshiva gave is pretty much defining a category and using that category to unify, I use this principle a lot, unifying logic spans a range of details. All these details prove that the category is defined so-and-so. Okay, now, let me get to Kobe's question and to Sam's question, to Alicia's question. The assumption of Lamdanim is that this thought process was latent throughout all the generations and all the conversations of Tanayim and the Amorayim and the Rishonim. They didn't have to articulate it clearly because it was so intuitive and so obvious to them. When they said a detail, they gave a principle, it was obvious to everyone in the room they were circling a category, maybe disagreeing about the definition of the category. We'll talk about that later. That was Sam's original question. But it's clear the Rambam didn't have to articulate, is it a din in this or a din in that? The same way, just to use a sports metaphor, if I land in New York City or in Cleveland and I say the word touchdown, there's a range of associations that you immediately fire up with the word touchdown. How many yards, how many points, how many scores, how many ways to score, how many legalities that can disqualify the touchdown. And then all of a sudden, if I landed in Melbourne and I said the word touchdown, no one would know what I'm talking about. So when the Ramban and the Rambam and Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Chisda and Rabbi Abaya and Rabba and Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai and Hillel and Moshe Rabbeinu, they knew it so well and so holistically, they just start snapping their fingers. And that's why the Gemara just for a different example, talks about crazy cases. And for outsiders, these crazy cases seem ridiculous. They seem eccentric. They seem off the wall. Who cares about two people holding onto a talis? Does that really ever happen? They pick it up at the same time? No, that's not what they're talking about. They came into the Beis Medrash today and they said, let's talk about halachic definition of possession. But instead of articulating it in 20th century vernacular, let's talk about possession. They said, Shem Mochsim Atalis, contested possession. Two people holding it. Are you the Mochsik? Am I the Mochsik? When I didn't grab it from you. They knew it so well, this was just a trick to get people to engage in the conversation. And the positions they took, Migo, not Migo, were reflective of so many categories that are pulsing beneath these details that they knew so well. And at a certain point, we lost that ability to think and articulate. And Reb Chaim was reconstituting and revitalizing by institutionalizing and articulating. That's what I call, and you'll see this when we talk about more the technique, overlapping layers of lumbus. That's why you can take a machlokas rishonim and a machlokas achronim and a machlokas tanayim and a machlokas amarayim about different details, because they all hinge and revolve around the same logical categories, because we assume that they were thinking, which is an epistemological assumption, that human beings want to think in categories. Hashem didn't just deliver a bag of details. Here's the details. I just want you to have 100 billion details that you study. But Hashem, in any logical system, details are offsprings of categories. So the language may change, the body language may change, the way you define things, but essentially, categories is what drives these debates. Machloksin are not just arbitrary. It's not as if Abaye woke up on the left side of the bed, and Rav woke up on the right side of the bed. That's why Abaye came to his opinion, and Rav came to his opinion. Even if it is true, Abaye was having a hard day, Rav was having an easy day. We'll talk about deauthoring positions from the original authors, but I'll talk about that a bit later. Let's take a break now, because Alicia had a question, and Sam had a question, and Kofi had a question, and then we'll get to multiple truths and machloksin. Yes?
Just going back to what you're saying about...
I'm just trying to draw a line where we are, yes.
The scientific method in asking how and what only and not losing track of the why. I think many people, including one of our Rosh Yeshiva, see that as a failure, and that we're losing out on a big part of the what Torah is about if you don't ask the why.
I think you're referring to Moshe Lichtenstein's article. I think you misunderstood me. Even if you believe we should ask why, and I think almost everyone believes you should, you shouldn't confuse or conflate the two. Now, it could very well be that at certain stages of history it became imperative to completely dismiss and completely marginalize the why in order to establish that clear boundary between what and why. And Rav Moshe's article, in my opinion, was an attempt to reintroduce the why back into the curriculum after 30 or 40 years in which it had been intentionally, consciously marginalized in order to heighten consciousness and sensitivity to the why.
Why do you think it was marginalized? The tone is wrong there. Why do you think it was marginalized? Why do you think
I think that the Rav and Rav Lichtenstein had to, in their own worlds, had to work so hard to institutionalize the Brisker Derech and to propagate it and popularize it and to establish clear boundaries between what and why, that they never denigrated. In fact, the Rav talked about this a lot in Yishal Lachab. Rav Lichtenstein never told us don't ask why, but it just never came out. He poured so much of his focus and his energy into the what and his shir, and I think Rav Moshe said, well, now we're the next generation of Talmidim, and now we've received that system, and we're practitioners of that system, now let's reintroduce the why. He was trying to, there's no machlokas between him and any other Rosh Hashiva, certainly not any other Rabban, certainly not me, about the importance of why. But he was just sounding the trumpet. Now let's start asking why again. Sam.
Do you view this reflexive attitude or self-consciousness of what we're doing as an inherent part of this meta, mapping things out, like the other yeshivas where they're not dealing with larger concepts? Is that because they're less aware of what they're doing? Or do you use distinct things?
I don't know. In my own biography, I became conscious of the process sooner than I became conscious of the megastructure. No one ever articulated any of this to me, so I didn't have the luxury of having a Rebbe articulate all this to me. But I was very conscious that I was being taught the process. Rebbe Lichtenstein gave a methodology shiur every Sunday morning. I was very conscious that I was now acquiring tools and honing tools that I was applying. It wasn't just aimlessly wandering through Shas trying to come up with answers. It was a process and a methodology that I was employing. The sense of meta-categorization, again, no one ever articulated it to me, but I came to it later in the stage. At least for me, they were never joined at the hip. You're asking me an autobiographical question. I can't. It's hard for me to answer that. You have to find people who have consciousness without meta-sensitivity.
Does one confer to the other in terms of what's more?
Not necessarily. Again, consciousness leads to probing, and you're looking for answers to justify the process. So if you're not conscious, you're just practicing, you're just exercising Gemara, so you're probably not thinking about the process, you're not thinking about the connotations or the structure. So general awareness, game awareness, as people say, knowing where you are in the game, you know, how many strikes. How many, so that type of game awareness tends to make you sensitive not just to how many strikes, but how many outs and how many runs you're ahead by. The general game awareness makes you aware of a range of different game-related factors. Yes?
How do you understand them? How is Michigan method dividing into categories in a way that other methods wouldn't?
I don't think that other methods don't, although I'll talk about other methods a little bit later if we get to it. But categorization means, how do we define the mitzvah of lekichas lulav? Let's gather what type of lekichas puzzle, what type of medium you need, is chatzitza kasher, you take them together, and then I'll come up with a category called lekichas lulav. And then I'll compare that to other lekichas, let's say, lekichas ezov, and lekichas tefillin, or lekichas paraduma. So I'm trying to define, I'm not just interested in whether the handkerchief creates a chatzitza, and what type of chatzitza between my hand and the lulav is or isn't the psul. I'm trying to define the anatomy of a lekichas lulav, and to come up with a cogent statement. Lekichas lulav is to lift, is to hold, is contact, is not contact. Okay? Other drachim, like I said, briskers don't feel there's other drachim, not in terms of monopolizing drachim, but in terms of assuming Rishonim understood this intuitively. And as we lost that trail of Torah, other drachim became less sensitive to this, and we're just restoring it. Now, I'll get to other drachim today a little bit later. Kobe?
Is there some sort of noticeable change from like the Rishonim in the Mishnah to the Achronim, of where we notice that this derech has been lost, that Rav Chaim had to recover it? I mean, like, we're assuming that, you know, Rav Chaim recovered this derech, it was just so intuitive in the Mishnah.
Right. You'd probably be better off asking a starting that question. My sense is that the seismic shift, or the tectonic shift, was a publication of the Shulchan Aruch in the 1550s. When that happened, everyone's attention shifted away from Shas and shifted towards Shulchan Aruch. And it changed so many aspects of Torah. That was really one of the most defining moments in the history of Torah. For example, Professor Tashma has a very interesting article. He asks, what defines the Rishon and Achron? We did this very, very facile. We almost compromised. You say everyone before the Shulchan Aruch was a Rishon, everyone after the Shulchan Aruch was an Achron. But what characterized the way the Rishonim wrote? What characterized the Achronim wrote so that we can actually look at someone in the 20th century and say, well, he wrote like a Rishon? And look at someone in the 14th century saying, well, he was more involved in Achronish issues, even though he lived in a timeline that we normally associate with Rishonim. And one of his distinctions is that Rishonim didn't separate between halachic works and Gemara works. And the Ramban was writing his Parash on Shabbos, he was writing Shulchan Aruch, because there was no Shulchan Aruch. So if you wanted to know what the Pesach was, you read the Gemara, and then you read the Ramban's Parash in the Gemara, and then you reached the Pesach, or he reached the Pesach. And all of a sudden, after the Shulchan Aruch is published, we see demarcation. Are you writing a Lamdisha work, or not Lamdisha, at least an analytical work, or you're writing halacha work? So the Pnei Yeshua is writing an analytical work in the Gemara. There's no halacha that he's striving towards, whereas Shulchan Aruch and those who follow in the regular Shulchan Aruch writing halachic works. So that has a tremendous change, the focus on the Shulchan Aruch. I would say that in many ways shifts people and shifts their style of learning and significantly alters, along with many societal factors, Chassidus and Kabbalah, and Pilpul becomes very, very popular. I'll talk about the difference between Pilpul and Lumbus a little bit later. Okay? But first I want to talk about the Briscoe Lumbus and make sure that you see the clarity of what's happening in Briscoe Lumbus. Let me get to Sam's question and then we'll talk about other Drachen. This makes sense if there's one line and one stream of thought that we're trying to uncover. We're just assembling the details and trying to hone our sights, our crosshairs on that one truth. But Gemara, and we'll talk about this from a technical methodological standpoint, Gemara is characterized by debate, multiplicity, duality, machlokes, havamina maskana, lishtakama, lishtabasra. So it's a heavy price to pay just to find that one truth. There's one truth that's out there. We want to find that one emes of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And we have to put up with all this debate because human beings forgot what the one truth was. And maybe even in theory, if Gemara invites us to encounter that truth, the toll or the price may be too high. Well, that presumption is very, very anti-Lamdas. Some Nanim don't believe that. And again, some people say, articulate this other model. Some people just feel it in their bones and they're not conscious or able to articulate it. That first presumption assumes that Machlokas represents the degeneration or the deterioration of the Masar. As if at Har Sinai Hashem gave one truth to Moshe Rabbeinu. For years and years when they studied Torah avidly, assiduously, they retained that truth. Then at a certain point, as the Gemara says, the Talmidim of Hillel and Shammai, at that point they became more lazy. The Gemara uses this language. And in their laziness, they forgot what the answer was. And then Machlokas erupted, and in any one given Machlokas, one of the positions is veering towards the truth. One of the positions is heresy. And unfortunately, we don't have the filtrations. We have to study everything just to cover our corners, to cover our bets. That's not the way Lamdanim, or that's not the way I see the Masara. HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Har Sinai delivered multiple truths, each of them being correct, in a way that I can't explain to you because that's not the way we process reality. Human beings are binary. So for us, just to take a simple example, it's either day or night. Right now it's day, about to be night. But right now it's day, can't be night. Black and white, on or off. Kadosh Baruch Hu is Yotzer Ar, Uvarei Choshech, Aseh Shalom, Uvarei Sakal. So for Hashem, it could be night and dark in the same time, in the same experience, in ways that I can't even begin to explain to you because I don't have the resources and you don't have the receptors to even have any of this make sense. But Hashem took something and held it up for Moshe Rabbeinu, said, you see this item? This is Tameh. And not only is it Tameh, there are 49 different ways to achieve that status. And it's also Tahar, this item in a particular predicament. And there are 49 different ways to achieve that Tahar. The Gemara talks about Simchas. Simchas, we learned a lot about Simchas last year. He's always taking odd positions. Simchas was a Talmud Rav. Anyone know? Rabbi Meir. So Simchas had that fresh set of eyes, and he was always taking strange positions. He held Maman Matta Basavik Cholkim. Simchas was able to actually recreate the 49 pathways of Tumah and the 49 pathways of Tara. Niels Bohr was a Dutch physicist. Niels Bohr once said, the opposite of a true statement is a false statement. The opposite of a profound statement is another profound statement. So Kadosh Baruch Hu didn't issue true and false. He issued profound statements. And in the early stages of the Masara, their minds were so strong and their understanding of the system was so profound, they were able to reconcile and integrate ideas which to us seem contrasting and conflicting. And they were able to see them as one and as whole. The closest I can come to explain this to you is to contrast my experience as a 50-year-old with your experience as 18-year-olds about ideology. Right now, the way you see ideology, he's a chassid, he's a Haredi, and I'm a datilo man, and it's one right way. Should you serve in the army, not serve in the army, and secular? All these issues that you debate ideologically. And in your minds, if you're honest, you can't see there being more than one truth. If you're honest with yourself, of course, you're tolerant, you understand, you may not be the right word, but you really feel there's one truth that you're looking towards. And then as you grow older, you realize, no, there are two sides of one equation, they're going to be reconciled as multiple truths because you're trying to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu can't be grasped through one access point, and you find your truth, and they find their partial truth, this is all partial. So I can use that as a metaphor, so to speak, for possibly understanding how things which to me seem binary, Patur Achayev, Mutter Asr, I'm so far downstream and I've lost the integrated model of Hashem's will. And of course, I'm a human being, so I never had it to begin with. So all I can do is to build multiple truths, and I can't see them as reconcilable, but at least I know that they're each a little nugget and a little shard of Hashem's complete, integrated, indivisible will. So for me, I can combine them. Now, part of the problem is also that you live in a post-Shulchan Aruch world in which there's been a real bifurcation between practice and study. So in practice, there is one truth, and that truth is normative, and that truth is obligatory, and that truth is universal. It's called halacha. Forget Ashkenazi and Sephardi for a moment. And then you study, and you're plunged into a world of multiple truths. So it's dichotomous. It's contrasting experiences. If you lived in the pre-Shulchan Aruch world, this would all seem much more natural to you, because you would live in France, and your Rebbe would be Rabbeinu Yaakov of Tam, and he would instruct you to make Kiddush such and such. And you would live in Seville, and your Rebbe would be the Ramban, and he would instruct you to make Kiddush a different way. And you would live in Italy, and your Rebbe, or Southern France, or in Pasquiez, was the Ravid, he would instruct you to make Kiddush a third way. And everyone was comfortable with pluralism in halachic practice, because they all represented multiple truths. No one fought, no one, obviously there was points of conflict and clash, but there's a sense that halacha could be practiced in different fashions. It wasn't one truth. Your Kiddush is a Kiddush, my Kiddush is a Kiddush, and his Kiddush is a Kiddush. And then, 1559, this system shifts, for good reasons, into a more stable, cohesive, authoritarian, homogeneous system, monotonic, which everyone's making Kiddush the same way. So you get duped into thinking there's one truth, and then you bring that preconception into the world of Gemara, and it just isn't correct. It's just a concession to history that halacha had to be systematized. An important concession, a concession we have to maintain, but nonetheless a concession. Now, someone asked before, how rigid is this? So, does that mean that everything you say is part of the system? Let me ask the question differently. The Gemara in Sukkah, what we all learned on Daf Chaf Chasim and Aleph, has a statement of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The gist of the statement is he knew everything. Medrash, Mishnah, blah, blah, blah. And the end of the laundry list of everything Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew was Kol Ma Shetalmid Vasek Asad L'Chadesh. Anything that a Talmud would ever say, any svara that a Talmud would ever say, was given in Har Sinai, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew. Now, there are two ways to read that, literally and figuratively. The literal way, which is, again, mind-blowing, but much of our discussion of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, by definition, has to be mind-blowing, or else it's paganism. If you make it too understandable, then you're a paganist. You're shrinking Hashem into human dimension. So one way to read that is Hashem literally told Moshe at Har Sinai, every svara that you can find in the Sefer. You go to the library, you find the stipler. Tomorrow, Yair, you say svara in the Yavesh, Hashem told him that svara as well. Every svara that anyone would ever say, Hashem told Moshe, at a certain level, they knew Torah so well, and their command of Torah was so comprehensive and supernatural, they knew every svara. Different ways, based on a medrash, in Parashat Kitisa. Parashat Kitisa, Vayitein el Moshe kechaloso ledeberito. So the medrash darshins, kechaloso miloshon klalim. Hashem gave Moshe the klalim. So maybe Hashem didn't tell Moshe every single little svara that every single Talmud would ever initiate, but Hashem gave him the ground rules. Think of a sports game. So every coach has their own place, and no coach knows the other coach's place. They make up their own place, but there's a certain set of ground rules that all the coaches have to follow. You only have 24 seconds to shoot the ball, you can't travel, you can't foul, and based on those ground rules, he concocts his play, you concocts your play. So obviously the ground rules of halacha are a little bit more extensive than just three or four rules of 24 seconds and walking and fouling. It's and maybe thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of ground rules. But within those parameters, you can issue a svara, and that accords with the system. Hashem gives a system, and Sam expects human beings to develop the system. But as long as every logic that's consistent with the ground rules, it stems from the system, it becomes a product of a divine marriage, or a marriage between the divine system and human innovation. And Hashem wants that, because that weds human beings and their imagination to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well. Okay? Pause. Any questions about this issue? So we now talked about, just to review, we talked about the purpose of Lumdus. We talked about the scientific method of Brisk, what it stresses, what it doesn't stress, how it's practiced, how it's not practiced, the assumption that it's latent. Now we talked about Mechalotzin. I'm going to talk about two other issues very quickly. One about deauthoring the process. It sounds like a fancy word. I'll explain it. Don't worry. The second issue is, what about other drachim that are clearly not Brisk? Not just because they are mini brisk, because they're not as conscious or they're not as mega brisk, but what about those drachim which are clearly of a different approach? Sam?
Is it possible to say that the idea that everything which will ever be said was said at Har Sinai is basically sort of a canonization of later innovation or of human innovation?
Yeah, if you take it literally.
Speaking less in the halachic sense, but more in the hermeneutical or what's the word for midrashic sense? I forgot the word for
that. Homiletical.
That's the word I was looking for. In that sense, do you think that would be a fair reading?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a literal reading.
Not to be too liberal?
I think it's a literal reading. Everything was... Again, it still doesn't eliminate freedom of choice because I don't know what was said in Har Sinai. I'm still free to innovate. But everything I innovate, by definition, was already spoken to Moshe at Har Sinai and was understood by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and Abaye. And therefore, of course, that's what makes them so authoritative, because they incorporate all those ideas and they came to the following conclusion. Yes?
In the newer generations, those ground rules were passed down so everyone knew what they were, or they had to be like adopted through learning and other...
Some are intuited by learning the system. So, for example, when the Gemara says Lamali Kras Svaro, right? The Gemara is talking about a Motzmi Chavel Avar, we learned the last name of Avakamba. So, the Gemara searches for a pasuk and it's only Kras Svaro. Doesn't mean it's a Svaro that you and I would sit on a couch and come up with. It's a Svaro that if you know Shas so well, it's latent in the system, it's part of the system. If I ask you, tell me the generality of your experience in Gush. It's not like anyone told you that. You've been in Gush for X amount of time and there's something that's so fundamental to the way things take place here that you come up with a certain idea about life, or it's implicit in the system. So if you study the entire Torah, it's implicit in the system. Alicia?
How do we differentiate between legitimate svaras and illegitimate svaras? If you say any innovation or any svara, I say it was by definition said at Sinai, it can't be true because some svaras are wrong.
Right. They're wrong when you can blow the whistle on them. So you blow the whistle, number one, because they veer out of bounds, to use the sports proverb, because they conflict with a fundamental principle that can't be argued. So many principles are supple enough to be flexed and changed. It's not really amigo. It is amigo. It's not really otza. But when you say something that clearly contrasts with the set of systems that serve as parameters.
Is that line not often blurry?
Of course it is. Of course it's blurry. And also at some points it's just so illogical and so preposterous that it just simply is anti-rational. But that line is even more blurry than the line of parameters. But certainly there's a line beyond which you can't bear. Yeah, Phil, you had a question? Okay, just two questions. There are two final points. I've used the word deauthoring, okay? Did the Rambam really mean that? Or, and we'll talk about this when we get to the level of technique, how can you say that the Ramban in Shabbos suggests that Kiddushin is X, and then in the same breath, and I did this a lot in Shir, you quoted a Ramban in Ksuvos, and that suggests that the Maisa Kiddushin is Y. So what did the Ramban really hold? So, the goal of Lamdos, the first goal, is there a chug now? Should I stop? You have a Shana Bet Chug? Who? Okay, so maybe we should stop. Is that fair again? Because it's not going to take 2 minutes. So I'll pick up from there, then I'll start the technique. Okay, I'll talk about deauthoring and the role of Arthur Drachim, okay? Next time is?
Today is Monday, I think. Next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday, 5:15.
At 6:15.